Yeah, it's a hybrid class. It's great.
Because
it's still 8:30.
I have a different class.
It's a flipped class.
I was saving one time.
It's a flipped class.
It was a
complicated.
Yeah.
I basically learned nothing from this course.
Oh, I saw that video.
That's great.
You gotta read this.
I have an A, right?
You gotta read the syllabus. You have to read the syllabus.
Hello. Can you hear us?
Yeah.
Yay! I had IT come on Monday to take a look at everything, and they fixed it, so
great.
It was nice. Great. All right. So you're up on the big screen. So, there you go. All right. So. Everybody could just put a check mark next to your name. I'd appreciate it. Did everybody do the reading assignment?
Yes.
Okay, good.
This is a pencil though.
What?
So before I forget, next week's reading assignment will be the next three chapters 5 through 7. And then after that, the reading gets a little lighter after that. But read chapters 5 through 7, and that's under coding 2. It's in three phases. Coding 2 is in three phases, chapters 5, 6, and 7. So that's pages 42 to, I think, 76. So please do that for next week. We're really working our way through this book. So I have a little presentation for you all to try to explain what we're going to be doing this semester and how we're going to be doing the coding. A couple of you have already reached out to me about being the first author on a poster, and I appreciate that. We're a little bit early in the sequence, but I'm glad that you're thinking about it. Last year, we didn't start the lab until October, and so we were already behind the eight ball, and then no one had ever gone to a conference before. And so this year we're in a very different situation where A, we started in early September, yay, a month earlier, and B, we already have some lab members who not only have attended conferences, but have presented at conferences. Right? So we're doing really well, I think, so far. Let me just go into a little bit more depth about what I sent you earlier today. Everybody get that email message? So I was thinking, okay, so where in my professional history have I actually done qualitative coding. I'm known as a quantitative researcher. I don't do qualitative research. I thought this would be a cool project because, namely because last year we did a quantitative study, and so the lab members who were repeat offenders have already been there, done that, and so I thought, well, how can I make this a little bit different for the repeat offenders? And so I thought about, let's do a qualitative research project. So that's how that came about. So I was thinking, scanning back in my memory, and I remembered that 9 years ago, my wife Alita and I published a qualitative study of some Ugandan caregiver data that we had collected. We conducted interviews of Ugandan caregivers, and we analyzed those transcripts using Auerbach and Silverstein, the grounded theory model. And so what I sent you was the product of that. That was an article that we got out of that research. And actually, she and I did all the coding. We did everything ourselves. We didn't rely on any students. She's first author, I'm second author. She's now vice provost of libraries and museums. It's a little known fact. So I gave you that, so you can look at that to see how we went about doing this. I'm going to be reviewing the basic mechanics today. But I thought, well, what does a finished product look like if you were to write this up for an actual paper? So I sent you that. And then a year earlier, I had led a coding team of doctoral students to code some children's data that we had collected in Uganda using the attachment story completion task. Basically, it's a family of dolls, and what you do is, actually, Justin read about this in class last spring, but so you tell a series of story beginnings, and then the child finishes the story. So one story, for example, it's about a rock. So the family's out walking in the park, or the hills actually, and the child says, look, mommy and daddy, watch me climb this high, high rock. And you have a prop, it's an actual rock. And the doll climbs up the rock kind of tentatively and then falls. And the child screams out, I hurt my knee. And then you say to the child, show me what happens now. So typically you do this kind of procedure with 3 to 5 year olds, but you can actually do it for kids up to age 9. So what we did was, and there are 5 of these stories, so that's one of them. I'm not going to go through the other 4, but what we wanted to do was to explore the nature of the familial roles in the family from this sample of rural Ugandan children. And we used Auerbach and Silverstein, the grounded theory model, to review and analyze all these interviews of all the children from our study. And, you know, everything was transcribed, and we just dealt with the transcriptions, not with the video recording, so all the coders had the transcriptions. And I had one student who led the team. Her name is Michelle Fanciullo, and she since graduated with her doctorate, and she's now in private practice. Just had her first child a year ago. She organized the poster for that particular year in 2013, and was presented at a conference. She presented at a conference, and so I sent you the actual abstract that she submitted. It wasn't the APA, it was the New York State Psychological Association conference. It was a slightly different, smaller conference, but she submitted it there, got accepted, and then I also sent you the final poster in digital form that was created in PowerPoint. So you have an actual journal article with grounded theory that I wrote with my wife. You have the abstract to a student-led poster, using grounded theory, and you have the actual poster that was presented at an actual conference by an actual student in 2013. So I thought those are three items that you might find interesting, right? Especially if you're going to be a first author on a poster. These are items that you might find helpful as you think about what you might want to be doing. You'll notice that in the abstract, the student makes it very clear that the coding has not been completed, that it's ongoing, and that she's still formulating her ideas, right? Because this is a qualitative study. We're not hypothesis testing, we're hypothesis generating. So there is no hypothesis. There's only a research question or a research concern. And we're gonna get into that today as I go through the presentation. Any questions about what I sent you today? Anything about what I've said so far? Anything? Nothing? Okay. Oh, okay. Yeah, great. So, thank you for passing that around. So let me go to the slides. And Elisa, maybe I can share screen and then you can see the slides too. Have you ever been part of a qualitative study? I never asked you, I don't think.
I've been a part of a qualitative study for a little bit, just like we're waiting for the IRB approval for it. And then my IRB project, or my integrative project thesis, is also a qualitative study. I'm a really big fan of qualitative work, so this is exciting for me.
All right. That's great. I'm going to mute my microphone for you, I think. Is that going to help me? Can I mute the microphone?
I don't know. I feel like both sounds are coming from there.
Oh, you think so?
Yeah.
Interesting. So maybe from the Epson and then from the speakers on the wall?
Yeah, that's what I feel like.
Okay. That's good to know. I'm going to have to call IT because when they were here, they noticed that the sound was coming only from the Epson, the projector, and not from the speakers on the wall. And the IT guy said they should be coming from the speakers on the wall, but apparently he forgot. Or maybe he needs to change the setting on my laptop so that it's not coming from the Epson anymore.
Can you maybe turn it off? iPad?
It says it's on mute. So, I don't know. Anyway, Elisa, you were echoing a little bit when you were talking, and I was just trying to figure out the source of that, but I'm not going to waste time on that. So, feel free to speak up when you want to. Okay. Let me find my presentation. Whose?
Harris.
Yes, and you know, I reached out.
This is the same coding.
Yes, were you on her coding team?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, okay, all right. I had forgotten that you were actually on her coding team, because I actually reached out to her and asked her if she wanted to make a presentation on her dissertation. And she said that she's on internship this year, and she's actually working during our lab hours, so she wasn't able to do that. So, you know, I'm going to be presenting a more general presentation, but that's good to know. So you're actually very well versed in this stuff.
Yes.
All right. So I have a
laser pointer, but it, I don't think it's charged, so it's still charging.
Anyway, that's my PowerPoint. So we're going to be talking about exactly how you do this kind of research, this kind of coding that we're going to be doing. It's challenging in the sense that it's a lot of close reading and highlighting of different aspects of the text, and then taking that text and putting it in another document. So you're copying and pasting a lot. But it's not anything like last year where you guys were trying to figure out, is that a 3 or a 4? I can't make up my mind. Let's look at the anchor points, and where does it fall in the anchor points? None of that. So you're spared that, Carolina.
Yeah.
All right. So you have qualitative research, which, as I've shared with you already, is hypothesis generating. The outcome of the research is to generate hypotheses that you can then use and test in later quantitative research. So this is like a first step to conducting an actual quantitative study. So a lot of researchers don't take this step, right? They go to the literature and they figure out what's been done before, but this is a really great way of getting information from, like, on the ground. That's why it's called grounded theory. Like, what do actual participants say about their experience? And what can we generalize from that experience to then formulate hypotheses? So, as an endpoint of this research, you should be able to formulate a hypothesis that can be tested quantitatively. Okay, so it's grounded theory because it's coming from the bottom up. We're actually going to the actual raw data of what people say about themselves in interviews, and then gradually generalizing to other people who are part of the interview process, and then building theory from that, from what they actually say. And if you read the article I sent you, you'll see that we actually quote specific research subjects, right? Participants in our study, we actually quote to as illustrations of the theory that we developed out of this grounded theory approach. So you can actually, the data are in the text. Everything is in the text. There's nothing else extraneous from the text. If we were to write this up as a research article, which is a possibility, certainly we could report on mean age of the. I don't know that all of these participants have shared their age, so we might not even be able to report mean age. But in the study that we sent around, that I sent around, we do report the mean age of the caregivers. We also report the mean age of the children in the poster that I sent out. So there is some descriptive statistics that are permissible when you conduct a qualitative study. But other than some very basic demographic descriptive statistics, generally statistics are not used in qualitative research. And in this particular project, now that I'm thinking about it, I don't know that we'll be recording any descriptive statistics, namely because a lot of the stories don't include, at least systematically, they don't include your typical demographic statistics like age, class, income level, race and ethnicity. I don't think that people routinely report that in the stories that have been published in these two books that we're going to be reviewing. So I'd have to read through the stories again to verify that, but I don't know that's going to be a possibility. Which is fine, and it's totally fine. It is nice to know like what the age range is, and the gender is something that I think we could probably figure out. in both samples. But, you know, that'd probably be the only demographic variable that we could extract from these stories. So
that's what I have to say about that.
So the method of this data collection analysis focused on narratives, right? So people telling us their stories rather than numeric information. There are no numbers, only narratives. And so how do we boil down their narratives into what's really important to what we want to understand about them? So this method addresses the individual and it addresses the group. So we're interested in what each individual says about a particular topic, whatever our research concern is, but then we're also interested in broadening it to include all members of the group. All right? Which is approaching some kind of what they call a saturation point, theoretical saturation, which means that you reach a point in your data collection where each new interview, I didn't send out these slides, by the way. Okay? It'll save you a lot of typing. Let me make a note to myself to send the slides to you guys. Let me just quickly make this note. Okay. So, theoretical saturation is a point at which when you reach a certain number of interviewees, let's say 24, I think they recommend 20 to 24. Anyway, the 25th, 26th, 27th interview, you're not learning anything new. There's nothing that interviewee number 25 says to you that hasn't already been said by interviewees 1 through 24. When you reach that point where you kind of exhausted what you can learn, that's when you stop collecting data. That's how you normally do it. This is a slightly different study because we're actually not collecting new data. We have stories that have already been written that we're going to be analyzing. And so there's no theoretical saturation. We have a certain number of stories for the sex addicts and a certain number of stories for the food addicts, and we're going to be coding all the stories. I think it's 41 and 44 or something like that. So like 85 stories or so we're going to be coding. Now some of the stories are fairly long, 6-7 pages. Some of the stories are like page and a half, 2 pages. So it's not a lot of text. But I think it's going to be enough for us to do something with. So that's what I mean by addresses both the diverse and common aspects of each individual experience. So individuals differ in their experience. You know, the book talked about Haitian fatherhood, right? So some Haitian fathers differed in some respects in their fatherhood experiences. And then they also shared common experiences between each other, among each other. So we're going to be looking at both the diversity of experience, let's say in recovering from food addiction, and the commonality of experience. I know for a fact that in all 85 or so stories, there is going to be a common theme here. The theme is that their life was completely, you know, messed up. They had some kind of experience or set of experiences that you know, led them to seek out a higher power and to get into a recovery program. And then the third act of their story is going to be what their life is like now, how they've improved, how life is so much better for them after having gone through or started a recovery program. So that is going to be common, that theme of life was shit, you know, there's a crisis point where they had to make a decision to get into recovery or not. and then what life has been like in recovery since they made that decision. So you, all the stories are going to have that general thematic organization. But there are going to be a lot of differences, a lot of individual differences in how these people got to where they are today, in leading, you know, functioning lives without their drug of choice. So, and then the third point here is that the participants, right, not us, are the experts about the object, or the project of the study, the object of the study. They know best. What do we, I mean, some of us might be in recovery programs, I can't say, but, you know, overall, like, what do we know about addiction? What do we really know? We can read all the books in the world about addiction, but do we know it personally? Do we know it subjectively? Have we been there? Have we been in the gutter? You know, these folks have. They're speaking from personal experience, and that's why what they have to say, their narrative, is so powerful and so important for us to understand. Because we, perhaps, have never been there before. Experientially, we might have all the book knowledge and all the intellectual knowledge, but we don't have any experience actually having been a sex addict or having been a food addict. And so it's important for us to really understand their experiences. They're teaching us. We're not teaching them. They're teaching us. That's an important distinction, I think, with qualitative research. Any questions so far? All right. So, as I mentioned, this is hypothesis-generating research. It's aimed to describe and understand subjective experience, usually of an understudied population. And I think, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think sex addicts and food addicts are probably somewhat understudied, especially if you compare them to, like, alcoholics, drug addicts. Like, the substance addictions are much more widely studied than what's known as the process addictions or behavioral addictions. So that would include, like, internet overuse, sex addiction, food addiction, gambling addiction. I think all the behavioral or process addictions are much more understudied compared to alcohol and drug addiction. Everybody has read something about alcohol and drug addiction. How many of you have actually studied a behavioral addiction? I think far fewer of you. So I think it is an understudied population, which would lend itself to this kind of work that we're going to be undertaking this semester. And where we want to generate meaningful hypotheses that might be tested quantitatively at a later time. Right? So the end point of our work is to formulate hypotheses. Now, last year, Daniel will, and Charles and Carolina will remember that we started with a hypothesis. That was the starting point. In fact, you know, Charles and Daniel, you know, wanted to be first authors, and they wrote an abstract and said that the first thing you need to do before you even put pen to paper is to formulate a hypothesis. That's the number one thing that you do first. Before you do anything else, give me a hypothesis, and then we'll work backwards from that point. And so they gave me hypotheses, and we worked on it, and we crafted it, and we worked on it some more. So finally we got a hypothesis that I was happy with it. And then they could do some lit review and build around it and, you know, like, make it look really beautiful and nice. And then we submitted it to reviewers at the APA, and they accepted the abstract. But that was the starting point. You start with a hypothesis. And that's true with a quantitative dissertation as well. You start with a with a dissertation, it's more than one hypothesis, but you start with two or three hypotheses. If you're really ambitious, four hypotheses, and then you work backwards and you create, you know, a literature. This is that starting point last year is the end point this year. So we're going to end up with a meaningful hypothesis that we formulated. And then maybe next year we could try to talk about how to test it. But this year, the end point is a hypothesis. We're spending a whole year doing what we did in a month or two last year, right? But the difference is that these hypotheses are going to be grounded in actual experiences from actual participants who know something about this field, not with their brains, but with their hearts, with their experience. Okay? Elise, if you want to add anything, feel free to do that. Good so far?
Yeah, good so far.
Okay, all right. So let me talk a little bit about grounded theory. So we start off in grounded theory research with the idea that we're dumb. We don't know anything. Okay? And I'll tell you, for those of you in this group who want to become clinical psychologists today, that's a very valuable attitude to have. When I go into a session with a patient, and I see patients on Fridays, Saturdays, and Mondays, every time I go in to see a patient, I have to adopt an attitude of, I'm dumb, I don't know anything. Which isn't really true, but it's important to assume that attitude of as if I were dumb. Because if I don't assume that attitude, if I just assume, well, I know everything in this patient, I know this patient better than themselves, I know what they're going to say before they say it. If I have that attitude, I'm not going to be helpful to them. It's first of all, it's disrespectful, and second of all, I'm not going to learn anything new that I can then help them with if I know everything already. Also, I'm modeling a very poor attitude for life, right? If I walk around knowing everything, I'm not going to have very many friends. I'm not going to be a vessel for learning anything. I don't know how anybody who adopts that attitude can learn anything in a class. If you know everything already, how are you going to learn? Like, I was taught that the best learners are empty vessels. You know, they're waiting to be filled. And if you're not waiting to be filled, if you know everything, then your cup is already full. You don't need to learn anything from me if you know it all. Right? So we're going into this research being dumb. We don't know. We haven't been there. We don't know what it's like to be a sex addict or a food addict. So we're going in dumb. But we want these people to teach us. The participants are our teachers. Right? So after developing a theory, then we can generate, you know, hypothesis, but we engage in theoretical sampling. I've already hinted at this already. So we collect data on participants who differ from those of the initial study. This is what we're going to be doing here with the two different samples we have. So I haven't decided yet which one we're going to do first, either sex addicts or food addicts, but we're going to pick one. And then we're going to see how the second sample might differ in certain respects of their experience from the first sample, right? So how do food addicts differ from sex addicts? Now, we know that they have something in common. They both have behavioral addictions. So they're both in the same general class of addiction, but obviously food is different from sex, okay? And I'll tell you one very important way in which they're different. Just off the bat, off the top of my head. So with 12-step programs, it's important to become abstinent. What does abstinence mean? Anybody know?
Don't do it.
Right, you're done with that. So like for alcohol, abstinence or sobriety, as defined in alcohol 12-step programs, is you don't take another drop of alcohol. It's very well defined, right? But when you get into behavioral addictions, it gets a little harder. Now, gambling, okay, I'm not going to gamble anymore. Well, what if you dabble in the stock market, right? So I have mutual funds. It's a form of gambling in a way, right? There's risk. I could lose a lot of money. If the stock market crashed today, I would lose a hell of a lot of money. So I'm gambling. So if I were a gambling addict, should I have mutual funds? I'm just playing devil's advocate here, right? So, but in general, I think don't go to casinos, don't play fantasy football, you know, I mean, that we can kind of figure out, you know, we're not gonna do that if we're in recovery from gambling addiction. So let's go to sex addiction, right? So are we telling people you can't have sex anymore? If sex is a problem, right, and I can't stop having sex, so is abstinence a goal? Just don't have sex. Now, theoretically, you could do that, right? Sex is not mandatory for survival, right? If I didn't have sex for the rest of my life, that might be sad, but I'm gonna live. I promise you I will survive, right? Priests do it all the time, you know? So, and monks do it, right? So it's not gonna threaten my survival if I did make that commitment to abstinence, if in the same way as an alcoholic makes a commitment to abstinence, right? So in these kinds of programs, you know, they make exceptions. So if you're married, for example, you can have sex with your wife or husband, right? Or in some other 12-step programs like SAA, if you're in a committed relationship, you can have sex. Well, what does committed relationship mean? You gotta define that, right? So it's a little bit more a gray area. But you see the problems now, right? So we go from alcoholism, which is like, okay, no alcohol. I mean, it's pretty well defined, to, geez, I can't have sex anymore? Well, that doesn't seem fair. And like, how can I have sex? Well, there are certain parameters under which you can have sex. All right. Then we go to food. Okay? You can't be absent from food. That will be the end of your life. So that would threaten your survival. So I think food addicts actually have it the hardest of all, because they're addicted to food, but you need food to survive. So how are you gonna manage this? So you have to learn to be able to eat with some sort of, you know, regulation, self-regulation, some kind of control. Now they would say, well, we're powerless over food. We don't have any power. So the idea is that you put your faith in a higher power who helps you to control your food intake, right? So you give up power to the higher power who then works in you to help control your eating. But you see the differences? So in sex addiction, theoretically you could give up sex and it wouldn't harm you, your life. Food addiction, it would harm your life. So already there's some differences. So it's just a long way of saying that I think we are gonna probably find some differences between these two groups of addicts, the sex addicts and the food addicts, okay? Now whether we could codify that in some way and go in with a research concern along those lines, that's up to you guys. But that's something that I've been thinking about, that we could certainly ask the data to give us instruction on. Okay? All right. So, let's get into the nitty-gritty. Now, some of this isn't going to be applicable to us because we already have the data collected, so to speak. We're actually going to be coding interviews that have been published. And I've already consulted the IRB and we're good. No IRB issues, obviously. But I just want to share with you how you would do this if you were actually collecting new data. Because some of you might go to grad school someday and well, Justin's already in grad school, but you know, you might want to go for a doctorate and you want to figure out, I want to do a qualitative dissertation for my doctorate. Okay, these are the steps you would take. So participants are recruited via snowball sampling. You guys remember what that is from the reading?
Yeah, it's basically like a tiering scheme. So you recruit one person, and you get that person to recruit other people, and those people recruit other people to get the pyramid. And
exactly, exactly. So there's lots of. So only the one at the top wins. That's exactly right, actually. So the reason how it differs from quantitative sampling is that in quantitative sampling, you want to try your best to collect a random, so-called random sample. You know, and I think Auerbach and Silverstein make a very good point. There really is no such thing as a random sample, unless you're doing like a big, huge epidemiological study where you've got 10, 20,000 people from all over the United States, and you use like the equivalent of a phone directory to randomly select a sample. You know, samples are not, I'm a quantitative researcher, so I know for a fact one of the best kept secrets in quantitative research is that there are no random samples, all right? We pretend that we have a random sample, but it's not random, okay? Snowball sampling doesn't maintain any pretense. You know, they say, we know it's not random, we're not gonna pretend that we're doing random sampling. So this is snowball sampling, and based on theoretical saturation, which I explained earlier, you know, it doesn't really matter. At some point, you're not gonna collect any new data. So what's the point in collecting 100 subjects if you can collect basically everything there is to know in 24 subjects, right?
That just seems crazy.
What?
That you could collect everything that you could possibly know in 24 interviews?
That's what Auerbach and Silverstein have experienced, that you reach a saturation point, and it's usually around between 20 and 24 participants.
I take you at your word, and theirs. It just doesn't, it just...
Yeah. No, I mean, let's say you want to collect 100 interviews.
Yeah.
Let's just say...
Yeah.
Hypothetically,
sure,
right? I mean, at interview 75, you might learn something different. There's an interview 75, member 75, he or she might say something you've never heard before.
But it's
that's
like the
great, but
point is diminishing returns. Like, yeah.
Much different. Yeah, because then you've interviewed subjects 25 to 74, and you learned absolutely nothing.
To get the one little nugget that you learned
from interviewee 75. And then you're going to interview 76 to 100 where you don't learn anything else.
Mm-hmm.
So how much wasted person power
sure.
in that experience? So their claim is that generally pretty much everything you're going to want to know about a research concern is collected in those first 20 to 24 interviews.
For a particular sample.
Yeah.
Like
right.
Or a particular population
yes.
that you're trying to study.
Yes,
okay.
So like Haitian
yeah.
fathers.
Yeah, yeah.
For example, or like food addicts versus sex addicts. Oh yeah, Elisa.
Yeah, have they found the method of the qualitative research to some like people say that you can even get it from about like 10 to 15 interviews, depending on the questions that you're asking and as such. So you can get it from like a saturation you can do from a very small population.
Right. So. There's some people in the field who suggest that you actually reach theoretical saturation earlier, not later.
Mm-hmm.
So exactly what Elisa was just saying. So.
Well, as a researcher, that's kind of good news.
Yeah, I mean, but look, we always emphasize this in grad school. I always did anyway, and my colleagues did the same thing. Like, don't think that qualitative research is easier. It's not easier. In fact, I don't know if Taylor might think it's harder. It's a lot of work. It's a lot of work. Certainly, the collecting the data might be easier because you're doing, let's say, hour-long interviews on 20 folks. So that's 20 hours of data collection versus like you're collecting, you know, survey data on 100 subjects. That to me is probably a lot more labor intensive, but the coding is not going to be any easier. Justin?
So if you get a group of 10 people, would that hit the 10 saturation point with one group of interviews? Would that one group solidify the interviews?
Yeah, they wouldn't. they wouldn't suggest that you do just one, right? In fact, they say groups of 4 to 6. So if you have like 3 or 4 groups, that would be ideal. Because the problem, and Auerbach and Silverstein make this point in one of the chapters, that if you're interviewing in groups, there are advantages and disadvantages to interviewing in groups. The advantage is that one person says one thing, and that triggers a memory or an idea or an experience in another member, and then they'll share it. And so it's kind of like a group memory retrieval system, which is nice, right? The disadvantage of group interviews is that a certain culture develops in that group interview, which might, you know, veer off in a particular direction. For example, let's say you have 1 or 2 group members who are very dominant and they do all the talking. And then it really becomes an individual interview with 5 other participants who really aren't saying much because they're afraid to speak up, or they just don't know how to get a word in edgewise, or, you know, so that's the disadvantage. So if you're gonna do group interviews, you wanna do at least several group interviews to avoid this group think in just one of the group interviews. So I actually prefer individual interviews, and that's what we did in Uganda. So the article that I sent out earlier today is a grounded theory approach where we actually interview people individually. And when you read these stories, they're obviously individual stories. They're not, these folks didn't write their stories in a group setting. They wrote them individually and submitted them for publication. So, any questions about that? Okay, so then the interviews are obviously transcribed verbatim. That's mandatory. Because what we're gonna be doing after that is like a really close textual analysis. And you're not gonna be able to do that with just audio recordings or video recordings. This is like really highlighting specific, you know, prepositional phrases, and you know, that's really important. We'll get to that. So the transcribing is crucial. We've already got transcriptions, right? So we're good to go with that. Let's see. So here we go. This is the coding. All right, so when you see the red raw text, what that means is that's the interview. So in this case, it's the person's story. So that's the raw text. Nothing's been done to it. It is what it is. So now, I put down here 3 independent coders, but it doesn't have to be 3. It could be more. It could be as little as 2. How many coders, Elisa, did Taylor use for you guys? Like, did she break you up into coding groups, or did you all group all the same?
So Taylor just had me and one other person and myself. And we all did it individually, and then we came together to do the assignment.
So she only had 2 coders in her entire dissertation?
3, including herself, technically.
Okay, I didn't know that. Who was the other coder?
I forget her name, but she was in a lab with us. She was also an undergrad.
Oh, she was an undergrad. Okay. All right. Yeah, I could figure it out, but that's helpful. So Taylor Perlman was a long-standing lab member at LIU in my lab, and she conducted a dissertation, qualitative dissertation, actually on alcoholics, ironically. And her research question was about rock bottom. What does rock bottom look like? So that was her general research concern, and then she actually collected. She collected data from, I think it was a podcast, right?
Yeah, it was a podcast that she transcribed. It had a lot of stories about people's like recovery journeys or why they decided to, or what their like movements were. So yeah.
Right, so she also did a kind of an unorthodox data collection technique. So rather than collecting fresh new data, she, I forget the name, I think it was called the Bubble Hour, right? It was the Bubble Hour. It's a podcast, I'm not familiar with it, but she went into the Bubble Hour and she transcribed a number of interviews. So there's the podcast host, I don't remember his or her name, he or she would interview, I don't think they were celebrities necessarily, right? They were just normal, average, everyday people who would come on the program, and he or she would interview them, and they would talk about their recovery, right? What basically give their story. And so Taylor went into a certain number of these interviews, and she actually transcribed them. And then she applied the grounded theory approach to these interviews, and her research question was, you know, what was rock bottom like? That was her question. And so she wrote a dissertation about this. I was not her dissertation mentor, but I was on her committee, her dissertation committee, and you know, she passed with flying colors. I don't know if she has any intention on publishing her dissertation research, but I had wanted her to come here and actually present her dissertation research focusing on the mechanics of the coding, which she's on internship this year, her fifth year clinical psychology graduate school. You go on a full-time internship at a hospital usually, but or a VA center or something. So she's a fifth year student doing that, and she's actually seeing patients during this time, so she was able to do that. But anyway, she used this method, and Elisa, our wonderful program coordinator, was one of Taylor's two coders for her dissertation. So, and that wasn't that long ago, right? That was maybe a little over a year ago.
Yeah,
so a little over a year ago. So in Taylor's case, the Bubble Hour was the raw text, the interview, right? So then you slowly, gradually move to greater levels of abstraction and generalization. So you go from the raw data, which has a lot of noise in it, right? We really care, you know, what kind of a car the food addict was driving when they went to the 7-Eleven to go on a binge. Does anybody really care what kind of car he or she drove to the 7-Eleven? No, so that's noise. That's raw text that nobody in this room is ever going to use. We don't care about the kind of cars food addicts drive. That's not our research concern. Our research concern, hopefully, will be something a little bit more substantive, right? So we go from raw text to relevant text. So the car situation is irrelevant text. I don't care about the car. I care about other things like, you know, what it was like to recover from food addiction, right? So how do they feel about that? So relevant text is parts of the text that are relevant to the specific research concern, okay? So once you look at relevant text, you highlight it with a yellow highlighter, or you make some kind of annotation that sets that text apart from the irrelevant text. So by the time you're done with a particular story, some of the text will be highlighted and some of it won't. Hopefully, the text that talks about the car, that you know, the Chevy Impala that the person drove to the 7-Eleven is not going to be highlighted. Okay, hopefully, please. I had a friend who told me that she was in Overeaters Anonymous and that would help me with my out-of-control eating, and so I went with her to a meeting. Guess what? That would be relevant text, I would think, for most of us here. So that's the first step. And then we just keep getting narrower and narrower and narrower. So, and Elisa, you actually have done this more recently than I have. I haven't done this in 10 years. You just did it last year, so please correct me or add in whatever you want to here. So then you take the relevant text. So we throw away the irrelevant text. Now we're left with the relevant text. Now we're getting to the juicy parts. Then we look for repeating ideas. These are ideas that are expressed by two or more research participants. Right? So we go through all the data in, let's say, the food addicts. We've highlighted all the relevant text. Then we're looking for text that repeats, meaning that there's more than one person who has expressed a similar idea. So let's say another person in the story says, I heard about Overeaters Anonymous from a friend, and he or she invited me to a meeting, and that's how I went to Overeaters Anonymous. So then, being asked by a friend to go to an Overeaters Anonymous meeting, that's a repeating idea.
I don't want to think aloud? No, I'm not ready.
You just keep it to yourself.
Yeah.
You're so stingy, Daniel. All right. So then you have these repeating ideas, right? So you go through all 42 or whatever stories and locate these repeating ideas. What ideas repeat? Now obviously, you put them in a separate document, and you also label which story you got the repeating idea from, right? You don't want to lose sight of who these people actually are. So we can just label them 1 to 42. Right. Each story also has a title, which is helpful, but we can just label it with the number of the story. So then you go, then you have the repeating ideas. Then you look at the repeating ideas, and you kind of think, okay. And this is, a lot of this is somewhat subjective. I want you to think there's some kind of quantitative analysis going on here. You look at repeating ideas, and maybe there's some repeating ideas that kind of hang together, that kind of fit together. So like, having a friend take you to an OA meeting, okay, that's a repeating idea. Another repeating idea is, people at the meeting came up to me and offered me a ride to next week's meeting. Maybe that's another repeating idea, but it's kind of similar, right? It's in the same ballpark as the first repeating idea, which was, you know, someone invited me to come to a meeting who knew I was struggling with my food intake, right? So then you kind of organize these repeating ideas into themes. So they're coherent categories. You might have, what, four, how many, do you remember how many themes Taylor had, Elisa?
I want to say around 20, but I could be wrong.
She had 20?
Yeah, I know, like, what some of the themes were. I think like the most prominent theme was guilt and shame. Another one was like family, help, and I remember. Those were like some of the more prominent ones.
Right. So remember, we're always having the back of our mind the research concern. So remember, Taylor's research concern was hitting rock bottom. So what led to rock bottom? Well, guilt and shame can be pretty motivating for a lot of people, right? You feel overwhelming guilt and shame, you'll do anything to release yourself or have someone release it for you. Guilt and shame are two of the most painful emotions that human beings can experience, right? So how do we deal with guilt and shame? We all have to deal with it somehow. Everybody in this room has guilt and shame. So these folks, apparently, got into recovery to help them overcome their feelings of guilt and shame. So that, I'm just trying to use this as an illustration for themes. I've got 15 minutes, so I'm going to kind of move through these slides.
got
a few more slides left. That's a little small there. So if you were a, if, well, you're all student researchers in a sense, right? Because, and I'm the faculty supervisor, but this would also work if you were in a graduate program and you were being mentored by a faculty supervisor on your dissertation. So when you get to the theme stage, right, you as the student are going to come up with themes, but and the themes consist of, right, a number of repeating ideas. The faculty supervisor, which is me in this case, is going to review your work. And I'm going to say, well, you know, this particular repeating idea, I don't think it really does fit in this theme. I think it fits in a different theme. Right? It's open to discussion. We can debate it. We can eventually, hopefully, we'll come to some consensus about which repeating ideas belong into which themes. And there might be a certain set of repeating ideas that you've put into a theme, and I say, no, I think we should break those off, and they really deserve their own theme. These three repeating ideas seem to hang together, but they don't hang together with the rest of the repeating ideas in your theme. I think they belong to a separate theme. And so I might give you that feedback. So then we come up with a certain number of themes, and Elisa seems to recall that Taylor had about 20 themes. Right? I don't. Do you remember how many repeating ideas she had?
No, I think I had 10
per theme?
Maybe. I think it was actually like go around and check. Let me see.
All right, while you're doing that, I'm just going to move ahead here. So we move from themes, and then remember we're becoming increasingly abstract here, right? So then you move from themes to, what did I read? What did I write here? Theoretical constructs. These are just larger, more abstract ideas. So we organize now the themes into constructs. So if you have 20 themes, you might have 4 or 5 constructs. So each construct is going to have 4 or 5 themes attached to it. Some constructs are going to have like maybe only 2 themes. Others might have 7 or 8. But in general, you're going to have 4 or 5 theoretical constructs. And then after that, is the final step, which is writing a theoretical narrative. And the theoretical narrative is really basically just putting together all the theoretical constructs into some kind of coherent narrative that encapsulates the experience of all the addicts in your sample. It summarizes what you learn about the research concern that you started with.
Is that the last step?
That is the last step.
Okay. So just going through this, I'm just wondering, like, where's the hypothesis part? Like,
there is no hypothesis part.
I thought the end goal was to generate a hypothesis.
Well, it is if you want to take the next step.
I see. Okay.
To doing a quantitative study, you would take the theoretical narrative, which should suggest to you a hypothesis that you can actually test.
Okay, yeah, I think part of what was missing for me in these three chapters anyway, was just sort of like that link between, you know, something descriptive versus attempting to be hypothetically explanatory.
Yes, right.
So I guess that's what...
So, very good question. Embedded in the narrative is an explanation. That's what the narrative is. It explains the phenomenon.
I thought it described the phenomenon. That's
it describes,
it like
but
it
also, I mean, if a subject says, you know, I went into recovery because I felt so much guilt and shame over my behavior and how many people I've injured in my life.
Yeah.
That's an explanation.
I gotcha.
But
yeah,
if enough people say that.
But then you might take that and then apply that within the context of some sort of theory, and then say,
yes.
I think that the reason this is happening is because you know, they're whatever, they're responding to some psychological whatever theory.
Well, guilt or shame.
Sure, yes. Yeah, I mean, I think that's where, you know, that's where I feel like I got to the end of this and I was just like, okay.
Well, keep reading.
Okay, all right.
You're not even halfway done with the book.
I'm sorry.
It's coming, but no. But I mean, that's a great question. Like, I've been building up all along here to, you can actually test the hypothesis,
yeah,
right? So where's the hypothesis? It's a valid question.
Yeah,
but if you read the narrative, it's the hypothesis will be automatically suggested to you from the narrative.
Well, I did actually read ahead, and as they kind of down here, because I was looking for it. I was just like,
yeah,
okay, when's the part where you say like what you think, you know, like as opposed
right
to just sort of summarizing and describing it.
Right, right.
They do kind of get there. It's not like it's front and center, but
it's
I think a close reading did present some.
Yeah.
You know. Anyway.
But when you very practically, when you go to, if you're a first author and you go to write your abstract for the poster,
mm-hmm,
you're not going to be required to have that. You won't have it, right? Because we
yeah
won't be done coding by the time the abstract is due.
Okay.
Right? So
yeah
you're not going to have that. And even when you're ready to like create the poster, the beautiful poster,
mm-hmm,
for next August's APA conference, you might or might not have a testable hypothesis. That's not as important when we're presenting qualitative research.
Yeah.
If you were to take the next step,
mm-hmm,
okay, now I want to do a quantitative study. Obviously, you need a testable hypothesis.
Well, I do see how, because I went back and looked at like what were the research concerns they actually said, like in chapter one or whatever. And they did. They answered their question.
Right.
I mean, it does answer a broad kind of concern.
I mean, their claim to fame is that they did grounded theory because they didn't know anything about Haitian parenting. I mean,
yeah,
these are two Jews. What do they know about Haitian parenting, right?
Yeah.
So they interviewed these folks to learn about Haitian parenting, and what they learned was, oh, religion is really important to these fathers. We would have never even thought that this was a thing. Right, and then they can use that to formulate a hypothesis that tests.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
I gotcha. I'm just getting clear. So.
Yeah. So, are we good?
Elisa, I think you wanted to say something.
Yeah, about how many like things she had and the repeating ideas. She had about 15 themes, and she had anywhere from 3 to 10 repeating ideas.
Say the last part. There's an echo in here.
Yeah, she had anywhere from 3 to 10 repeating ideas per theme.
3 to 10 repeating ideas per theme, and she had 15 themes.
Yeah.
Okay, so up, I guess she would have had a maximum of like 150 repeating ideas, 10 times 15.
Yes.
But it was under 150 because in some themes there are only 3 repeating ideas. Okay? All right, I got 5 minutes and 2 slides left. I think I'm good. Oh no, I'm done. I forgot. So those are the references. And I will send you the slides. I'll do that tonight. And any questions about what this looks like? No. So as I said, it's been 10 years since I've led a coding team in qualitative research. It's not something that comes second nature to me, but I know enough about it to be able to teach you guys. And we have, you know, the skilled and talented Elisa in our corner. Helping us here because she actually did the coding just a year ago. And so I think we're in good hands. All right, 3 chapters for next week, and we'll see you then.
All right, thank you so much. Let me just.
Yeah.
There we go. All right, so I'll see you next week.
I mean, I still have like a month to work on it.
All right, bye bye.
Wait, is it right there?